You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course, given in Stuttgart in 1919 for the newly formed Waldorf School and its teachers. I would also like to mention that I am including a PDF of all the relevant diagrams that are going to be used throughout these 10 lectures. There are a number of diagrams, and I have found that it's very difficult to follow without their availability, so I will be making that available. This is Lecture 1, given in Stuttgart on December 23rd, 1919. Following up on the words just read to us here, some of which are already over 30 years old, I would like to remark that in this brief time at our disposal, I will only be able to provide you with highlights about the study of nature. First of all, especially since we do not have very much time, we can continue what we have begun here in the near future. And second, since I was informed of the intention of having such a course only after I arrived here, for the time being it will be a very episodic matter indeed. On the other hand, I want to give you something that can be usable for the teacher, perhaps less in the sense that it can be used directly as lesson content, than in the sense that it can inform your teaching as a certain basic scientific direction. On the other hand, given the multiplicity of contradictory theories presently circulating, especially in the natural sciences, it is particularly important for the teacher to have the right idea as a basis. With this in mind, I would also like to give you a few pointers. I would like to add something to the words that Dr. Stein has just so graciously recalled, something that I found myself forced to say at the beginning of the 1890s, when I was invited by the Frankfurt Free Seminary to give a lecture on Goethe's natural science. In my opening remarks at that time, I said I would have to limit myself to speaking, primarily, about Goethe's relationship to the organic sciences, since injecting the Goethean worldview into the study of physics and chemistry was a sheer impossibility. It is impossible simply because physicists and chemists are condemned by everything that presently exists in physics and chemistry to regard everything coming from Goethe as a kind of nonsense, as something that is meaningless to them. At that time I expressed the opinion that we would have to wait until physics and chemistry were led by their own research, so to speak, to realize that the structure of their scientific effort was leading to absurdity. Only then would the time come when Goethean views could also take root in the fields of physics and chemistry. Now I will try to reconcile what we might call experimental natural science with what we gain by the results of experimentation. I want to say a few words by way of introduction and theoretical explanation. Today I am aiming to work toward a real understanding of the distinction between popular everyday natural science and the scientific ideas that can be derived from Goethe's general worldview. First, however, we will have to go a bit into the theoretical premises of scientific thinking. Those who think about nature today in the popular sense usually have no clear idea of what their real field of research is. Nature has become a vague concept. Therefore, we do not want to begin with the popular view of the essence of nature, but rather with the way we normally work in the natural sciences. This way of working, as I am going to characterize it, is in fact somewhat caught up in transformation, and there is much we could interpret as the dawn of a new world view. But on the whole, the way of working that I am going to characterize for you today still predominates. Today researchers try to approach nature from three starting points. First, they try to observe nature in such a way that, on the basis of natural beings and phenomena, they arrive at concepts of species and genera. They try to classify natural phenomena and beings. You need only recall how these appear to people in outward sense experience. For example, individual wolves, individual hyenas, individual heat and electrical phenomena. And how researchers try to combine such individual phenomena and group them in species and genera, speaking of the species wolf, the species hyena, etc., and also of certain categories of natural phenomena. In other words, how they group things that exist individually. We might say, however, that this activity, though important, in natural science is actually practiced in a somewhat underhanded way. We are not aware that we would actually have to investigate how the general category we have arrived at by dividing and classifying is related to the individual phenomenon. The second thing we do these days, when we are active in the field of natural science, is to try to find what we call the causes of the phenomena, either by preliminary experimentation or by the following step, the conceptual processing of the experimental results. When we speak of causes, we often have forces or materials in mind. We speak of the electrical force, the magnetic force, heat, etc. But often we have something more comprehensive in mind. Behind the phenomena of light or electricity, we speak of an unknown such as the ether. We try to derive the characteristics of this ether from the results of experiments. You are aware that everything said about this ether is extraordinarily controversial. However, one thing can certainly be pointed out. In the attempt to arrive at the causes of phenomena, we are seeking the way from the known to an unknown, although without inquiring much about the justification for proceeding from the known to the unknown. For example, when we perceive some light or color phenomenon, which we describe subjectively as a color quality, we hardly take into account what right we have to speak as if the effect on us, on our soul, on our nervous system, were the effect of an objective process that takes place as a wave movement in the cosmic ether. Thus we would actually have to distinguish two things, the subjective process on the one hand, and the objective process, which consists of a wave movement of the ether or of the interaction of the latter with the processes in perceptible matter. This way of looking at things, which is beginning to become a bit shaky, is the one that dominated the 19th century, and in fact is still ubiquitous in the way we speak of phenomena, continuing to permeate our scientific literature. It permeates the way we speak about things. Then, there is the third way by which so-called natural science attempts to approach the configuration of nature, by looking at the phenomena. Let's take a simple phenomenon. If we drop a stone, it will fall to the earth, or if we tie it to a string and let it hang, it will pull in a vertical direction toward the earth. We collect such phenomena and arrive at what we call a natural law. Thus, we regard it as a simple natural law when we say that every planetary body attracts the bodies located on it. We call this force gravity and explicate it in certain laws. The three laws of Kepler, for example, are a paradigm for such laws. So-called natural science attempts to approach nature in these three ways. Now, I want to contrast how the Goethean view of nature actually strives to do the opposite of all three. First of all, when Goethe began to occupy himself with natural phenomena, he found the classification of natural beings and facts into species and genera highly problematic. He questioned the validity of inducing certain rigid concepts of species and genus from individual concrete beings and concrete facts. Instead, he wanted to pursue the gradual transformation of one phenomenon into another, to follow the transformation of one state of a being into another. What concerned him was not classification into species and genera, but rather the metamorphosis of natural phenomena as well as of individual beings in nature. The way that all post-Goethean natural science has gone into so-called natural causes was also not at all to Goethe's way of thinking. Concerning this point, Especially, it is of great importance to become acquainted with the principal difference between the method of current natural science and the way Goethe approached nature. Current natural science conducts experiments. It investigates phenomena, attempts to elaborate them conceptually, and seeks to form notions of the so-called causes behind the phenomena. For example, the objective wave movement in the ether as the cause behind the subjective light and color phenomena. Goethe does not employ any of this style of scientific thinking. In his research, he does not go from the so-called known into the so-called unknown at all. Instead, he always wants to stay with the known, without at first worrying about whether the known is merely subjective, an effect on our senses, our nerves, our soul, or objective. Concepts such as subjective color phenomena or objective wave movement out there in space do not figure with Goethe at all. Instead, what he sees revealed in space and taking place in time is something completely undivided, whose subjectivity and objectivity he does not question. He does not employ the thinking and methods used in the natural sciences to induce the unknown from the known. Rather, he employs all his thinking and all his methods to putting the phenomena themselves together, so that by juxtaposing them he finally arrives at phenomena he calls archetypal phenomena, which in turn, without consideration of their subjectivity or objectivity, express what he wants to make the basis of his study of nature and of the world. Therefore, Goethe stays within the sequence of the phenomena. He merely simplifies them, and then regards the simple phenomena that can be comprehended in this way as the archetypal phenomena. German, das Urphänomen. Thus, Goethe regards the whole of what we can call the scientific method only as a tool for grouping the phenomena within the phenomenal sphere itself, so that they reveal their own secrets. Nowhere does Goethe attempt to take refuge from a so-called known in any unknown. Therefore, for him, there is also nothing that we can call a natural law. You have a natural law if I say that in their orbits around the sun, the planets make certain motions that describe such and such paths. For Goethe, it was not important to arrive at such laws. What he expresses as the basis of his research are facts. For example, the fact of how light and matter placed, the fact of how light and matter placed in its path affect each other. He expresses the effect in words. It is not a law, but a fact. And he attempts to base his study of nature on such facts. He does not want to ascend from the known to the unknown. He also does not want to have laws. What he actually wants is a kind of rational description of nature. Only for him there is a difference between the initial description of the phenomenon, which is unmediated and complex, and the description gained by uncovering the simplest elements. Goethe uses these simple elements as the basis of his study of nature, in the same way that otherwise the unknown or the purely conceptually posited framework of laws is used. There is something else that can cast light, so to speak, on the content of our natural sciences, and on what is seeking to enter them through Goetheanism. Hardly anyone had such clear ideas as Goethe about the relationship of natural phenomena to the mathematical way of looking at things. Of course, this is always disputed, simply because Goethe was not a crafty mathematician. People dispute that he had a clear view of the relationship of natural phenomena to the mathematical formulations that have become more and more popular and are actually simply the safe thing in natural science today. The point is that the mathematical way of looking at natural phenomena, it would be false to call it the mathematical study of nature, the study of natural phenomena by means of mathematical formulations has become standard for the way that we imagine nature. We have to gain some clarity about these things. The usual path to understanding nature comprises three different kinds of approaches. People employ these three before actually arriving at nature itself. The first approach is ordinary arithmetic. In today's natural sciences, we calculate to an extraordinary degree. We calculate and we count. Now, we must be clear that arithmetic is something that people grasp purely through themselves. What we count when we count is a matter of complete indifference. By taking up arithmetic, we are using something that at first blush has no relationship to the outer world at all. We could just as well be counting peas as electrons. The way of determining that our methods of counting and calculating are right is an entirely different matter from the results we see and the process to which we apply arithmetic. There is a second approach that we practice before we arrive at nature itself. It is the way that we work with geometry. We determine what a cube or an octahedron is and what their angles are without extending our observations to nature. It is something we fabricate out of ourselves. The fact that we draw these things is only a function of our laziness. We could just as well simply imagine everything that we illustrate, and it is even useful if we just imagine some things and use illustrations less often as a crutch. It follows that what we express about geometric form is taken from a region that is initially distant from outer nature. We know what we have to express about a cube without deriving it from a cube of rock salt. However, the geometry must be found in the rock salt too. Thus, we do something that is distant from nature and then apply it to nature. A third approach with which we still do not penetrate to nature is what we practice in the science of motion, what is known as kinematics. Now, kinematics is actually also something quite distant from the real natural phenomenon. You see, rather than looking at a moving object, I imagine the movement. I imagine that an object moves from, say, point A to point B. There's a figure. I even say that point A moves toward point B. I imagine it. I can also imagine this movement from A to be composed of two movements. Imagine for a moment that point A came to point B, but that it did not immediately move directly to point B. Instead, it moved first to C, and he's drawn a parallelogram of forces here. If it subsequently moves from C to B, it also arrives at B. Thus, I can also imagine the movement from A to B such that it does not take place in the line A to B, but on the line or on the two lines A to C to B. That means I can imagine that the movement A to B is composed of A to C and C to B, in other words, of two other movements. You do not have to observe a natural event at all. You can simply imagine that movement A to B is composed of the two other movements. That is, instead of one movement, two movements can be carried out with the same effect. Now, if I imagine this, it is a pure construct, because instead of drawing it, I could have given you instructions for visualizing the situation, and that would have to be a valid concept for you. However, if there really is such a thing in nature as point A, for example, a single grain of shot, and it moves first from A to B, and another time from A to C, and then from C to B, then what I have imagined really takes place. In other words, in kinematics, I imagine the movements, but for this concept to be applicable to natural phenomena, it must hold for the natural phenomena themselves. Thus, we can say that in arithmetic, geometry, and kinematics, we have three preliminary stages of the study of nature. The concepts we gain from them are pure constructs, but they are authoritative for what happens in nature. Now, I would like you to take a little walk down memory lane into your more or less distant study of physics, and recall that you were once confronted with something called the parallelogram of forces, figure 1b. If a force acts on point A, this force can pull point A to point B. Now, by point A I mean something material, let us say a tiny grain. I pull it from A to B by means of a force. Please, note the difference between what I am saying now and what I said before. Before I spoke of the movement, now I am saying that a force pulls A toward B. If you express in line segments the measurement of the force, say 5 grams, that pulls from A to B, and there's an illustration, 1 gram, 2 grams, 3 grams, 4 grams, 5 grams, then I can say I am pulling A to B with a force of 5 grams. I could also arrange the whole process differently. I could first pull A to C with a given force, but if I pull it from A to C, then I can still carry out a second pull. I can pull in the direction indicated here by the line connecting C to B, and then I have to pull it with a force that corresponds to this length. Thus, if I pull A to B with a force of 5 grams, I would be able to calculate, based on this figure, how large the pull A to C must be and how large the pull C to B must be. If I pull A toward C and A toward D at the same time, then I'm still pulling A so that it will finally come to B, and I can calculate how strongly I have to pull A toward C and how strongly toward D. However, I cannot calculate this in the same way that I calculated the movement in the above example. What I determined above for the movement can be calculated as a concept. As soon as an actual pull, that is, an actual force is applied, I have to measure this force somehow. Then I have to go to nature itself. I have to make the leap from the concept into the world of facts. The clearer you become about the difference between the movement parallelogram, it is a parallelogram too if you add this point, and then that's the other corner, D in figure 1A, and the parallelogram of forces, the more clearly and precisely you will express the difference between what can be determined conceptually and what lies beyond the reach of concepts. Conceptually, you can arrive at movements, but not at forces. Forces have to be measured in the physical world. And only if you establish it externally by experimentation can you confirm that if two pulls are carried out from A toward C and from A toward D, then A will be pulled to B according to the laws of the parallelogram of forces. There is no conceptual proof whatsoever, as in the above example. Therefore, we can say that the movement parallelogram is derived by pure reason, while the parallelogram of forces has to be derived empirically through external experience. By distinguishing the movement parallelogram from the parallelogram of forces, you have the precise difference between kinematics and mechanics. Mechanics, which deals with forces, not merely with movements, is a natural science, whereas arithmetic, geometry, and kinematics are not. Only mechanics deals with the effects of forces in space and time. But one has to go beyond the world of concepts to arrive at this first natural science, mechanics. Even on this point, our contemporaries do not think clearly enough. I want to give you an example to illustrate what a mighty leap it is from kinematics to mechanics. The phenomena of kinematics can transpire completely within a conceptual space, whereas mechanical phenomena can at first be tested only in the physical world. People do not realize this clearly enough, so they are forever confounding things that we can understand mathematically with things in which entities of the physical world already come into play. For what is required whenever we speak of the parallelogram of forces? As long as we are speaking of the movement parallelogram, there need be nothing more than an imaginary body. But with the parallelogram of forces there has to be a mass that has weight, for example. That is something we have to realize. At A there must be a mass. Now you probably feel the urge to ask, what is a mass actually? To a certain extent you will have to say, quote, here I already falter, close quote. For as it turns out, whenever we depart from things that can be determined in the conceptual world, so that they are valid for nature when we go into them, we are standing on fairly shaky ground. You know, of course, that in order to get by, we equip ourselves, so to speak, with arithmetic, geometry, and kinematics, and a little bit that is brought in with mechanics. Then, by means of the mechanics of the molecules and atoms into which we believe so-called matter to be divided, we attempt to understand the natural phenomena that we initially experience subjectively. We touch a warm object. The natural scientist tells us that what we call heat is the effect on our heat nerves. What is objectively present is the movement of molecules and of atoms, which you can study according to the laws of mechanics. Thus we study the laws of mechanics of atoms and molecules, and we have long thought that by studying the mechanics of atoms, etc., it would be possible to explain all natural phenomena in general. Nowadays this idea is already beginning to waver. Even so, even if you penetrate conceptually to the atom, you have to inquire, by all sorts of experiments, how the force arises and how the mass acts. If you get as far as the atom, then you have to ask further how an atom can be recognized. To a certain extent, you can recognize the mass only in its effects. We have grown used to recognizing the smallest thing that we describe as a carrier of mechanical force by its effect. Thus we have answered the question by saying that if the smallest such piece of matter sets another piece in motion, say a small piece of matter weighing 1 gram, then a force must be exerted by that piece of matter which sets the other piece in motion. If this mass sets the other mass weighing 1 gram in motion, such that the other mass is accelerated 1 centimeter per second in a second, then the first mass has exerted a force that we have become accustomed to look upon as a sort of universal unit, in quotes. And if we can say that some force is so many times greater than the force that must be exerted to accelerate 1 gram 1 centimeter per centimeter in 1 second, then we know how this exertion of force compares to a certain universal unit. If we were to express this universal unit in terms of weight, it would be 0.001019 gram. That is 1 dyne, D-Y-N-E, translator. Thus we would be able to say that such an atomistic body, whose exertion of force we do not investigate any further in nature, is capable of giving any body weighing 1 gram a shove that will accelerate it 1 centimeter per second in a second. But how can we express what this force is made of? We can do it by going to the scales. This force is equal to the pressure that we read as 0.001019 gram on the scales. Thus I have to express myself in very real external terms if I want to get to what we call mass in the world. I can express what I conceive of as mass by introducing weight into the situation, something I have gotten to know externally. I express the mass only in terms of weight. Even if I go into the atomization of mass, I express myself in terms of weight. This is exactly the point I would like to describe, where we depart from what can be called a priori and arrive at nature itself. I want you to understand to what degree the results ascertained apart from nature by means of arithmetic, geometry, and kinematics are usable. You should be clear to what extent they can be definitive for something that actually meets us on a completely different plane. It first meets us in the science of mechanics and can only then actually be the content of what we call a natural phenomenon. Goethe recognized clearly that it is possible to speak of natural phenomena only when we pass from kinematics to mechanics. Because he knew this, it was very clear to him what the sole relevance of mathematics, which has been so idolized for the natural sciences, could be for this natural science. I would like to clarify this with an example. Just as we can say that the simplest element in the exertion of natural forces would be any given atomistic body capable of accelerating 1 gram, 1 centimeter per second in a second, we could also conclude that in all instances where force is exerted, the force emanates from a given point and acts toward a given point. Thus we could get into the habit, a habit that is quite the usual thing in the natural sciences, of searching more or less everywhere for points from which forces emanate. In numerous cases, we will see that we have phenomenal fields, and that we go back from these fields to the points from which the forces that dominate the phenomena emanate. Thus we speak of such forces, whose point of origin is sought as central forces because they always emanate from centers. We could also say that we are justified in speaking of central forces whenever we come to a point where quite specific forces emanate that dominate a phenomenal field. But it is not always necessary for this play of forces to take place. It can also be the case that there is merely the potential for this play of forces to take place, and that these forces will become active only if certain conditions arise in the surrounding area. In the course of these days, we will see how, to a certain extent, forces are concentrated in points without coming into play. Only if we fulfill certain conditions do they call forth phenomena in their surroundings. However, we have to understand that in a given point or a given space, forces are concentrated that can act upon their surroundings. That is actually what we always find when we speak of the world in physical terms. All physical research consists of pursuing the central forces to their centers, of attempting to penetrate to the points from which effects can emanate. Thus we have to assume that there are centers for such natural effects that are charged, so to speak, with possible effects in certain directions. Indeed, we can measure these possible effects by all sorts of procedures, and we can also express in measurements how strongly such a point can act. In general, when forces that can act when we fulfill certain conditions are concentrated in a given point, we call the measurement of the forces concentrated there the potential force. Thus we can also say that when we study natural effects, we are intent on pursuing the potentials of central forces. We go toward certain middle points in order to study them as the point of origin of potential forces. This is basically the path taken by the particular direction of natural science that would like to transform everything into mechanics. It searches for the central forces, or better, the potentials of the central forces. By taking the important step into nature itself is a question of clearly realizing that you cannot understand a phenomenon in which life plays a role if you proceed only according to this method, if you only search for the potentials of central forces. If you are studying the play of forces in an animal or plant embryo, you will never succeed. but in fact, the ideal of modern natural sciences is to study organic phenomena through potentials, through central forces of some description. It will be the dawn of a new worldview in this discipline when we arrive at the realization that the pursuit of such central forces will not work to study phenomena in which life plays a role. And why not? Well, let's imagine, for the sake of simplicity, that we wanted to study natural processes by physical experimentation. We go to the centers and study the possible effects that can emanate from such centers. We find the effect. Thus, when I calculate the potentials of the 3 points A, B, and C, I find that A can affect alpha, beta, gamma. Likewise, C can affect alpha 1, beta 1, gamma 1, etc. I would then get an idea of how the effects of a given sphere play out under the influence of the potentials of certain central forces. Using this method, however, I will never be able to explain anything in which life plays a role. Why? Because the forces that are involved in life do not have potentials and are not central forces. Thus, if you were to try in this case to find in D the physical effects under the influence of A, B, C, you would be able to go back to the central forces. If you wanted to study the effects of life, however, you could never say this, because there are no centers A, B, C for life effects. Instead, you can understand the situation correctly only if you say, quote, in D, I have life, close quote. Now, I look for the forces that have an effect on life. I cannot find them in ABC, and not even if I go further, but only if I go more or less to the end of the universe, in fact, to its entire surroundings. In other words, starting from D, I would have to go to the end of the world and conceive that forces are acting inward from every point in the sphere, coinciding in such a way that they all come together in point D. Thus, it is the complete opposite of central forces, which have a potential. How could I calculate potential for something that acts from all sides, from the infinity of space? It would have to be calculated by dividing the forces. I would have to divide a total force into smaller and smaller parts as I came closer to the edge of the world. The force would fragment. Every calculation would fragment too, because in this case universal forces, not central forces, are at work. That is where calculations cease, and that is, once again, the leap from lifeless nature into living nature. We can find our way to a real study of nature only when we understand first the leap from kinematics to mechanics, and when in turn we understand the leap from outer nature to something that can no longer be arrived at through calculations, because every calculation fragments and every potential disintegrates. By this second leap, we pass from outer inorganic nature to living nature. However, in order to grasp what life is, we must be clear how all calculations come to an end. Now, I have neatly separated out for you everything that can be traced from potential and central forces from that which leads to universal forces. However, out there in nature, it is not separated in this way. You could pose the question, where is there a situation where only central forces act according to potentials, and where is there the other situation where universal forces are at work that are not calculable according to potentials? There is an answer to this question, but it immediately indicates what important considerations have to be taken into account. We can say that in everything that people produce in the way of machines, which are put together from natural elements, we find purely abstract central forces according to their potential. Whatever is found in nature, however, even in organic things, cannot be studied solely according to central forces. That does not exist. That does not add up. Rather, in every case, where we have to do with things that are not artificially produced by people, what we are dealing with is a confluence that takes place between the effects of central forces and the effects of universal forces. In the entire realm of so-called nature, we find nothing that is lifeless in the true meaning of the word, with the exception of what people produce artificially, their machines, their mechanical products. In a deeply instinctual way, this was something that was both clear and unclear for Goethe, for it was an instinct on which he based his entire view of nature. And the contrast between Goethe and the natural scientist, as represented by Newton, actually derives from this fact. In modern times, the natural scientist has studied only this one thing: the observation of outer nature solely for the purpose of tracing it back to the central forces and for driving out of nature everything that could not be determined by central forces and potentials. Goethe did not accept the validity of such an approach, for to him what was called nature was only a lifeless abstraction under the influence of this approach. For him there was something real only when, in addition to central forces, forces from the periphery, universal forces, come into play. Basically, his entire theory of color is also built upon this contrast. But we will come to speak about that in detail in the next few days. I especially wanted to give you this introduction today so that you could understand the relationship of the human being to the study of nature. In our times, we have to devote ourselves once again to a study like the one we have carried out today, because now the time has come when we have a subconscious glimmering of the impossibility of the modern approach to nature, and some sense that things have to change. People still laugh a good deal when it is said that the old view of things does not work, but a time will come in the not-so-distant future when they will stop laughing, a time when we will be able to speak in Goethe's sense even about physics. Perhaps we will speak about color in Goethe's sense when another fortress that is regarded as even stronger is stormed, a fortress that even now has begun to crumble. That is the fortress of the theory of gravity. In this area especially, new theories emerge almost every year that shake the Newtonian conception of gravity, which relies purely on the notion that only the mere mechanism of central forces should figure. I believe that especially today the teachers of youth, as well as those who want to have a hand in the development of culture, must create a clear picture for themselves of how the human being stands in relation to nature. The end of Lecture 1.